I want to tell you a story that was funny to me, and I think it'll be funny to you, about a man that had a big honking SUV, and he was pulling into the parking lot of a fancy restaurant. And he was looking for a parking spot and finally found one. It was a little tight, and he began to back up in his parking spot without noticing a brand new gorgeous Porsche right behind him, slightly out of view. His backup camera didn't pick it up or something. And sure enough, he backed right into it. He hears the feels the thump, and he gets out, and he comes around the car, and with a sigh, he inspects the damage and sees this is a problem. And at just that moment, he looked up to see more than a few people looking at him from the restaurant windows. And he thinks, are you kidding me? And he begins to fish for a piece of paper and found one and a pen, and he, on the hood of his truck, wrote the following note: a number of people around me think that I'm leaving you a note that includes my name and number, but I'm not. And he slipped it under the windshield wiper and drove away. We smile at that story because it, let's just admit, it's amusing to say the least. And if you'll take off your little holy hat for a minute, you'll appreciate the fact that it's also ingenious. The guy was rather clever. And for a few more of us, we might even go so far as to say, you know, this guy actually, he was fast on his feet. I mean, how do you think of something that quick to get you out of a very big problem? Now, having said that, it illustrates a point that we're going to talk about this morning. That is that people, like that probably fictitious man I just described, but real people like you and me are really good at deception. That's probably the classic oxymoron of the year coming from these lips and this pulpit. We're good at deception. They don't fit together very well, but boy, have we mastered the craft. It virtually comes with being human. We're capable of twisting and spinning a story. And we learned it very young. In fact, really, really young. Like the practical answer a little boy gave his mother when she asked, "What is a lie, honey?" He said, "Mom, a lie is an abomination to the Lord, but a very present help in trouble." I was that boy. I hate to take the smile away from your face so suddenly this morning, but you know what? This is true about that little boy. He's right. And he's funny. And somebody answered that doorbell. I'm not sure what that was, but today we've even built on his humor and come up with a whole bunch of new names for falsehood. For example, and I'll just plunge right into this because it's everywhere today, fake news. Okay? Fake news has made all news suspect, in case you hadn't made that connection. So much so that it's the reason I don't take a newspaper, I don't take one, and I don't read one if somebody gives it to me. Why? Because who's this? I have no idea who put this stuff in front of me. And I don't watch television news for the same reason. Now, who can you believe is a question that I ask myself a lot. How do I know for sure that what they're saying is accurate and not reflecting some conservative or liberal bias? Okay, we're probably 29 days, I guess, from the end of 2017. And as wise people often do this time of year, they will look back on the previous year and declare it the year of. And there's a variety of things that probably will be presented, even one that hasn't happened yet, and I'm referring to the latest Star Wars. It's the year of the Jedi something, whatever. But one thing's for sure, this year will be remembered as the year of rampant, and I choose my word carefully, allegations against some very high-profile, very powerful people who are accused of doing some very terrible things. They span the sort of categories. They're not just in government. They have spilt over into entertainment circles. And the list is long, and I was tempted to explore it with you in my introductory thoughts today, but that's kind of unnecessary. You know that there's a lot of stuff out there that's really terrible stuff. And the allegations themselves should bring some measure of shame and embarrassment to a society that has people at such high levels that are accused of such terrible things. Now, lest I sound like I'm beating up on them, if you were to make your way into my study sometime, you would see a shelf of books about 2 feet wide in size, so maybe 20 volumes, that all, if you pulled one after another off the shelf, with names like Integrity and Who You Are When No One's Looking, and open the front cover of all of those books, you would see the copyright date of the 80s, 1980s. What did they have in common? The same thing we're going through now, only it was Christian leader after Christian leader who was crashing and burning. So this isn't a guy that's pounding on people or piling on. That's not my interest at all. My interest is to say, obviously, telling the truth isn't assured anymore in our society. There are a few in the news today that are admitting what they did, to which my cynical side says, yeah, are you admitting it because you were caught? Yeah, you think like I do. We think, come on, really? You're admitting it? But the vast majority continue to deny it. In fact, deny, deny, deny seems to be the favored diversionary technique. Deny it long enough and people will get tired of asking. And they'll move on. And you'll keep your job and everything else that goes with it. All of this makes the timing, of course, of our consideration of the ninth command remarkable, to say the least. When I came to this, I thought, wow, Lord, this is amazing. So what is it about that little boy who saw lying as a useful tool for staying out of trouble, something that you and I can relate to? We don't see him as just a charming little child. There's something in there that makes us go, oh, he's right. I've used that tool last week. What is it about that? To get some answers, let's gather again where we have each week in this study called the Ten Commandments, Laws of Love. My Bible's in Exodus 20. It's open already. I'd like you to turn there if you haven't opened this important starting point each week. And we begin by calling attention to the context of it. Verse 2, I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. And then across the page, we come to the ninth of Ten Commandments, verse 16. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. That's it. Raising this question, what does that mean? What does the expression false testimony point to? I did my search, as I do each week, and did some deep study on those words, false testimony. And most every translation of the Bible from the Hebrew uses those two words. Leviticus chapter 19, verse 11 says, very succinctly, do not lie. So we can say this much about it. It has something to do with telling the truth. Don't give false testimony. And if you add to that, Leviticus 19, verse 11, also written to these people that had been delivered by God from the slavery of Pharaoh in Egypt, God says to these people, his people, do not lie. So in one form or another, what's being said here is that lies have many lives. Don't bear false testimony is a very broad statement, but let's keep it narrow for a couple of minutes. In the narrowest sense, Exodus 20 is referring to God's people that were held captive until chapter 12 earlier, just eight chapters earlier, when they were set free. And the Exodus happened, and they were free. There were lots of them, just as a point of reference. You may think of these people and wonder, are they a couple hundred, couple thousand, a couple hundred thousand? By most estimates, the Bible gives us a reference to the men among them, which was 600,000, and most believe conservatively, based on family sizes and such in the day, that the number was about the population of Oregon, maybe not quite that big. 2.5-3 million people is what we're talking about. So God gives this counsel, ready for this, to people that had just been set free and were about to enter the land that God promised them, right? Well, that was right for only so long. They sinned. And because of that, a trip that could have been weeks in length turned into 40 years in length. And it spanned 4 decades, during which time God knew that somewhere among their ranks there would be conflicts. Brother, Hebrew brother against Hebrew brother. And accusations and allegations and the stuff that we see today. And so God says, wait a second, there's false testimony that's about to be part of just the normal ebb and flow of living here. And God, I love this about God, he doesn't pile on. And to keep people from making accusations that flatten another person and nothing's been substantiated, please don't go too far with what I'm saying. I'm not saying, hey, all those people we hear in the news are goody people. I'm done with that. What I am saying is God knew it was easy to make an accusation. So he raised the bar very high. He raised it so high, I want to have you see the bar. Deuteronomy 19. So we're in Exodus, just three books later. Go to Deuteronomy chapter 19. And remember I told you they wandered for 40 years? They're done wandering. They're days from entering into the land of Canaan in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy is second law. God is giving them the law again. And he restates the law, and then he gives this statement in chapter 19, verse 15. One witness is not enough to convict anyone accused of any crime or offense that they may have committed. A matter must be established by the testimony of 2 or 3 witnesses. Do you see how it's no longer just flippant? Hey, I think you did this, or I want to bring this accusation, and, you know, guilty because I said so. God says, no, no, no. Take it higher. And Jesus in the New Testament, if you fast forward to Matthew chapter 18, Jesus addressing the propensity for his people, Christians, to have conflict, invoked Deuteronomy 19 and said that the facts of a situation must be confirmed by 2 or 3 witnesses. He's pointing back to Deuteronomy. And if you were to go all the way to the Apostle Paul's writings in 1 Timothy 5, he says, don't entertain an accusation against an elder, pastor, a leader in the church. Easy, they're the biggest target, but don't entertain that. And he points back to this, unless by the testimony of 2 or 3 witnesses, every fact may be confirmed. And then you're to proceed with how to respond. So, for good cause, too. Listen to what one professor from Harvard Law School observed. Quote, on the basis of my academic and professional experience, I believe that no felony, he's a lawyer, no felony is committed more frequently in this country than perjury. End quote. What is perjury? It's lying, is it not? It's willfully telling an untruth. Lying. As the schoolboy confessed, it is indeed a very present help in time of need. But what other lives does a lie have? In the broadest sense, a lie is any form of false representation. That means if it's a spin you're hearing, that's a clever name for it, but it's a lie. If it's a twist, if it's a tale, if it's an embellishment. Now, let's be sensible people. There are some embellishments that are kind of fun, all right? I mean, you know, when I tell you that my father was roommates with Moses, okay? I'm just having fun. We're just, you know, I didn't lie. It wasn't Moses, it was Isaiah. So anyway, you get the idea, right? So we're having, it's all fun. That's embellishment that says, gosh, invite him to dinner. He's a fun guy, right? I like to be invited to dinner. Anyway, so let's talk about students. You're a student here. You have a child, a son or a daughter that's a student or a grandson or a granddaughter. When you're tardy for school, what do you say? Do you tell the truth or do you come up with some story? When you turn in a paper, this is your best work. But truth be known, you did a lot of Google search, and it's maybe not all yours after all. It's called plagiarism. Do you admit it? Do you say, you know, yeah, I guess I forgot to quote that guy. What do you do with that? It's a lie. You turn in something that you didn't write or you didn't say, and you didn't acknowledge that in quotations. See where we go? All right, let's move past students and let's talk about adults. When you were late to work or to that appointment, what story did you give? Well, last night was Monday Night Football and the game went late and, you know, my alarm didn't wake me up. Sorry. Or what's the normal answer? Car trouble, traffic. So let's just blame the car or all the other people in cars. Right? That's called a lie, and it violates the ninth commandment. It's straight up stuff. Distortion and exaggeration are included in the spirit of the ninth commandment. It's in essence a commandment about integrity. So the uncomfortable truth is lies have lots of lies. Solomon would later say, you can write this down, Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 6, don't let your lips cause you to sin. While I'm thinking of it, here's a great prayer. Psalm 141, verse 3, Lord, put a seal, put a guard over my mouth to keep me from saying things that are not true. Is that a pretty good verse? Psalm 141, verse 3. So question, and I mean this. Is lying just a bad habit? Or is it something that goes deeper than that? Because I got to this place in my study and I thought, well, okay, that's established. I think everybody's going to hear me say that lying's a pretty... pretty useful tool in some circumstances. And therefore, we all do it. And is it just kind of a bad habit? Or is it worse than that? Something dark. So I took that to the Bible and I found an answer. And I want to share that with you. But you got to turn the page back to Genesis chapter 3. Would you do that? Stay with me. Actually, Genesis chapter 2. And it answers the question, why we lie. Started in the garden in chapter 3. And the devil, in fact, is recorded as the first liar, first one to lie in the Bible. He demonstrates right out of the gate his deceptiveness and his craftiness. So the backstory here is in chapter 2, and you got to appreciate this to appreciate how the devil worked. Chapter 2, there's only Adam. Eve had not been created yet. And she's about to be created, but before that time, God says to Adam in verse 15, God took the man, put him in the Garden of Eden to work and take care of it. And the Lord commanded the man, Adam, you are free to eat from any tree in the garden, but you must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for when you eat from it, you will certainly die. Okay? So the rest of chapter 2 ends with God creating Eve, bringing Eve to Adam, and those wonderful words that in chapter 2, they were both naked and unashamed. That means these two are together as husband and wife, and they're roaming around this incredibly perfect, beautiful God gift called the Garden of Eden. And in doing so, it's presumed, and I think accurately, that Adam shared with Eve as they're wandering around going, man, those are good-looking trees, that grove of trees over there. What's that stuff hanging from them? And Adam's explaining as they go whatever he learned. We're not sure at this point how long they had been together in the garden. But Adam probably said, hey, that looks like a really great stream of water. Let's go swimming this afternoon. And along the way, Adam points out a certain tree that said that's the tree to stay away from. There's fruit on that tree that if we eat it, it could hurt us. So the devil shows up in verse 1 of chapter 3, the serpent more crafty than any of the other wild animals the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden? Okay. The devil's first lie was to cast doubt about the truth and ask, from any tree, really? And thankfully, his tactic was detected by Eve and corrected. Verse 2. The woman said to the serpent, No, you got it wrong. We may eat fruit from the trees in the garden, but God did say you must not eat fruit from the tree that's in the middle of the garden, and you must not touch it or you will die. Now, some people want to make a big deal of that last statement because that's not what God told Adam. He did not add, you must not touch it or you will die. He simply said, don't eat the fruit of it. I think that to make much of that is going way out on a limb. I think it's fair to say Adam probably said, hey, Eve, that tree, if we eat the fruit of that tree, we're toast. I mean, we will die. And so let's just tell you what, let's just not even go near it. Let's just stay away from it. That seems more sort of natural, does it not? To appreciate, and let's not fault Eve for going too far in her response to the devil. Enter the devil's second lie, and it was to question the consequence of disobedience. Come on, die? Don't be serious, verse 4. You'll certainly not die, said the serpent to the woman, for God knows that when you eat from it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God who knows good from evil. Really? And this time it worked. And may I add, to bring it right to now, telling the truth has been a tough assignment ever since. That's where it started. But Jesus doesn't leave us guessing, and I have to have you turn one more place to John's Gospel, the New Testament now. Would you go to chapter 8? And I know if you were here a couple of weeks ago, you know how to get there because we looked at an unnamed woman caught in adultery at the beginning of chapter 8. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are the New Testament Gospels. Would you turn to chapter 8 of John's Gospel? Jesus here is, after this time with this woman and all that went on with that, and it's in the Sermon on Adultery earlier in this series, so if you missed it, you can go back on the website and check it out. But Jesus is having a conversation, really a confrontation, with the spiritual leaders of the day. They're the Pharisees. These are the guys, the card-carrying legalists. These are the ones that walked with a pride, spoke with a condescending sound of verse 39, for example. John 8:39. Hey, Abraham's our dad. He's our father. We're his kids. That's us. And by saying that, they were saying, you know something? We are the ones that can trace our pedigree all the way back to Abraham at the beginning. When God took Abraham out and said, hey, look up at the sky. You see all those stars? I'm going to bless you with so many descendants, they will outnumber the stars in the sky. Making that point forward, everybody interested in being numbered among the descendants of Abraham. That's why verse 39, when they say, we have Abraham as our father, they were speaking with a swag. They were saying, he is our father. Failing to realize it had nothing to do with bloodlines. The New Testament says that Abraham was a friend of God. He was justified because he believed that God would make good on his promise. And the same thing makes men and women today, sons and daughters of Abraham, faith in God. Not whether you can prove you're from Jewish roots at all. Read Romans, that tells you that story. Romans chapter 4 goes into detail about Abraham and how they got it wrong. These people held on to this. We are sons of Abraham. And in saying such, they were claiming special privilege. So Jesus points out the error of their claim. And in the process, he says, you know what? Your father is not Abraham. Actually, well, we'll read it and you'll see how Jesus skillfully exposes their true father. Verse 39, if you were Abraham's children, said Jesus, then you would do what Abraham did. As it is, you're looking for a way to kill me, a man who has told you the truth that I heard from God. Abraham did not do such things. You are doing the works of your father, your own father. And they had to stop and go, what? Huh? What? We are not illegitimate children, they defensively protested. The only father we have is God himself. So they take it up a notch from Abraham to God himself. Jesus said to them, if God were your father, you would love me. Where's the love here? For I have come here from God. I have not come on my own. God sent me. Why is my language not clear to you? Because you can't hear what I say, that you belong to your father. And he removes all doubt where he's going. You belong to your father, the devil. And you want to carry out your father, the devil's desires. Verse 44. This is huge stuff. He was a murderer from the beginning. We just saw that. Not holding to the truth, for there is no truth in him. For when he lies, he speaks his native language. For he is a liar and the father of all lies. Yet because I tell you the truth, you do not believe me. Can any of you prove me guilty of sin? If I am telling the truth, why don't you believe me? Whoever belongs to God hears what God says. The reason you do not hear is that you, in fact, do not belong to God. And there Jesus drives a stake in the ground, declaring that every form of deceit can be traced to the devil, a.k.a., verse 44, the father of lies. Have you answered the question I asked earlier? Is lying just a bad habit? Something much, much darker. To use Jesus' word, devilish. Scary thing is, today, most of us do not see it that way. Average person hearing a sermon like this is going to go, ah, he's getting worked up. Yeah, I don't tell big lies, just a little white lie, right? Who gave it the color white? What makes a lie white versus dark or black or green or... What do we mean by that? It's not that big a deal. That's what we mean. Don't get too worked up, Pastor. A little white lie. Remember the little kid, a very present help in time of trouble. It's working for me. After we read Romans or John 8, how can we say it's working for me? We just don't see it, do we? Because everybody does it. French philosopher Blaise Pascal observed this about the downward trend of human behavior. Theologians call it depravity. Listen to his words. When everyone is moving toward depravity, no one seems to be moving. End quote. Same could be said about lying. With everybody doing it, it rarely stands out as something bad, much less sin. So I made a short list of how we do this. How is lying helpful in a time of need, as that little boy I keep referring to said? Let me use positive. We lie for positive reasons. You need a job. Virtuous. Good thing. And so you show up at an interview or produce a resume or an application or whatever, and there's embellishment there. So you present yourself in such a way that exceeds the truth to impress. You okay with that? I called it positive because the outcome's something we're after and everybody applauds the outcome. But was the pathway a good one? Let's go negative. It's easier to illustrate. To avoid consequences comes to mind. One of the negative reasons we lie, we deceive, we bear false witness, is to avoid negative consequences. So, ever been pulled over? Ever been asked by the officer pulling you over, do you know why I stopped you? And what was your answer? It was either no, and you were doing 90 in a school zone. That's not exactly an honest answer, okay? So we typically say, no, I can't imagine. And he tells you why. Do you just acquiesce and go, wow, I just didn't. And honestly, you didn't see that you were doing that? Yeah, your car. No, that's my truck. So I remember Trevor. I just got to tell this quick story. Trevor was a little guy. He was still, his Mickey. It was a pacifier. Little guy in the back of our van. We're coming back from the coast, and I had spoken all weekend at a retreat someplace there, and I had the whole family with me, and we're all tired, we're all sound asleep, almost the driver too. I was just pressing it to get home, and I'm just, skidding around corners in my minivan, and we're making our way home, and then I pass this car, because police have that radar that can catch you going the other way. That is just wrong. Okay, so anyway, And I see lights come up, and I pull over, and he comes to the window, and he asks, do you know why I pulled you over? And I'm like, no, man, it's just you and me on the road. I mean, what's the deal here? And he goes, well, you were exceeding the speed limit significantly. And I'm going, really? I mean, seriously? We're going to get worked up about that? It's late. I got to get my family home. I mean, there's church tomorrow. Why did I say that, And then from the back seat, I hear this. Trevor had pulled his pacifier out. He was old enough to be able to say this. Daddy, were you driving too fast? Get out of my van, Trevor. He called me on it, right? Of course I was. And like $100 later, $500, I don't know what they charged me. I faced my sin, a couple of sins. Ever come home late if you're a kid or remember when you were a kid and it was past your curfew? What story did you give? And why did you give it? To avoid consequence, right? I grew up in a church that had a morning and evening service. Dumb idea. My father was the pastor. And so we would go to church in the morning, and then we'd go play, my brother and me and our best friend Mike, and we would hop on buses and go cruise around Oakland, back when you could do it without a bulletproof vest, stuff like that. And it was really a good time. And we just got involved in our afternoon, and it was we were late getting back to church. And instead of walking up going, "Dad, you know, I'm really sorry," he sees us at the doors. They have these steps that come up to the church. And at the door, we had already talked this through, and all three of us are limping like this. And we spin this big story, "Dad, you know what? We're okay, but we had to dive out of the way of a bus because it was about to run us over." And he goes, I mean, he's just smart enough. He's looking at me like, "You really did lie, didn't you?" Actually, in the moment, he's going, "That was just, you know, that's so not true." And suddenly we all three got healed in the moment and revealed what I'm talking about here this morning. It's what we do. It's an ever-present help. It didn't work in that case, but it's what we turn to in the moment. Ever not turn in your homework? You know, I did a little calculation. There is no dog species big enough to consume all the homework they've been blamed for consuming. Not going to happen. By the way, in the moment, lying seems expedient, but we wouldn't do it. I'm going to give you two movies to watch over Christmas. You ready? One of them is going to make you blush. You're going to go, "He really recommended this movie." It's called Liar, Liar. How many have seen it? Oh, look at you. I thought there might be three that watch filth like, no, just kidding. You got to get past some moments, but I'm telling you what, it is an indictment. And then Big Fat Liar is a little more kid version, and it's really a must-see. So I don't know if we have it, but I'd loan it if we did. Which takes us to a final question. By far, it's the most important question of the morning. Does God really expect us to tell the truth? Always? I want to answer that by telling you the story of a king, and we'll be done. There was a king who was admired by everybody. He's a great guy. People named their kids after him. He was respected by everyone. And somehow found his way to making two very terrible decisions. The first decision was to break the seventh commandment, which is about adultery. He committed adultery. Second decision, terrible decision he made, was the sixth commandment, which is about murder. He did both of those things. And you could add lying, today's commandment. And he did those things, of course, in full view of God. God saw it all. But no one else knew. At least they didn't know the full stretch of it. Which is why he chose a path of cover-up. Remember the boy? A very present help in time of trouble? That's what this king did. And he has his sin exposed by God in the most incredible way when a prophet, trembling at his knees, points a finger at him and says, "It's all known. You're the man that did this, king. The terrible thing that you've done." Realizing that he had been had, the king admits, "I blew it. I've sinned terribly. And I've covered up my sin with layer after layer of lies." And then he answers our question, does God really expect us to tell the truth? By quoting Psalm 51, which he authored, this king did, verse 6, which says, God expects, some versions says requires, a few say demands truth in our innermost being, which can be translated all the way back to the womb. There's never a time for anyone in any circumstance where it's acceptable. For credibility's sake, I've included the times in the Bible where Rahab the harlot lied. And you can study those on your own. But God requires truth in the innermost being. And when God revealed that to David, that's the king, you figured it out. David said some things that were beautiful. He said in prayer and contrition of heart, purify me and I will be clean. Wash me, O God, and I will be whiter than snow. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Do not remove me from your presence and do not remove your Holy Spirit from me. Clean me up on the inside. Renew to me the joy of my salvation found in you and you alone. And then I will go on mission for you, and I will tell everybody I talk to how they can turn to you, dirt and all, and sinners will be converted to you. David did that, and from that day on, he could hold his head up. Proverbs 10, verse 9 says, she who walks with integrity walks securely. But he or she who perverts their way will be found out. God has better for us, and it involves truth at every level. You're a parent or a grandparent today. I want to give you the two best prayers I've ever prayed for my children. And I prayed them all the way. They're not unique to Debbie and I. We learned these prayers, and we prayed them for our kids all the way to today. The prayers are, God, keep my children from sinning. Secondly, God, when they sin, cause them to be caught. You know what, along the way, I pray that for myself. I'd like you to bow your heads, please. In three words, God says, tell the truth. It's the only way to live. Why he includes it in his laws of love. And we must settle for nothing less than absolute honesty. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Is there a way that you today are living a lie? You don't have to answer me. It's really not necessary, because God already knows the answer to that question. And he also knows that you're not, he might correct me even, you're not really living. To say living a lie, you're not really living at all with things as they are. So my counsel to you from God's word is join David. Start now to pray the prayer, create in me a clean heart. And he'll do it. If you pray that right now, he will do it right now. And he'll make it so that from this moment forward, you can hold your head up because you've got nothing to hide. No lie to conceal any longer.